Would you introduce yourself, please?
Hey, I'm Paul Noonan. I sing and hit things with Bell X1.
I think that there's so much to the story that's been told exactly the same way. Not by you, but by everybody else. They're the second biggest band in Ireland, and they're looking to make it big here, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
The second biggest band in Ireland, it always makes me laugh. It makes me think of Buzz Aldrin in The Simpsons, who said, second comes right after first. So, yeah, it's, you know, everyone needs a hook, right? And you two definitely cast a huge shadow over the arts in Ireland in general. And, you know, they've been, it's been hard to kind of climb from under it in some ways. Growing up in the time that I did, they were a massive influence on everyone making music. And, you know, some of my first gigs were U2 shows, and we got to open for them a couple of years ago, which was like a
amazing,
you know, incredible, yeah, half an hour of little of which I actually remember. But it was, yeah, just to kind of to see the machine at work in such close quarters was.
Well, the other thing is, we're talking early U2. We're talking 19. You know, we're talking late 70s here. So we're talking a long, long time. And yet, this band of yours, five albums deep, isn't exactly new either, right?
Yeah, we're 10 years on the go, and you know, we've only been coming to the States for the last 3 years, which I suppose is why we've kind of concentrated on it so much. I mean, growing up again on a stony outcrop at the edge of Western Europe, you got to get out. You know, you do to fulfill all kinds of things, to make a living, to feel fulfilled, you know, creatively, to see the world. I mean, that's a big part of why we do what we do. And we've, you know, finally got records out here, and we've been here, you know, 10 or 15 times since, in our, you know, 3 to 4 week stints. It's just somewhere we love being and feel like things are kind of growing organically.
There was this great quote that was in one of the interviews that I really liked, that you're taking on the U.S. 2 years at a time. So, you know, you're a 10-year-old band, you are the second biggest band in Ireland, but in the U.S., gosh golly, 2 years at a time, huh?
Yeah, I think, I mean, our strength has always been live shows, I feel. Even before the radio support kicked in Ireland, that's how we did it there, you know, that's how we did it for the first couple of records. And once we had that sort of foundation, when stuff started getting on the radio, there was that to build on, and it really kind of accelerated from there. And I kind of feel we're doing the same thing here, you know, in the absence of smash hit radio singles. I think there's something that's what you got to do. You got to keep coming and playing. And
another great quote that I like, but I understand it now because I went back and was listening to the record on the way here in the car. And one of the things you said is that you're taking, you know, for this particular record, you were taking a Gary Newman-esque approach to songs. And I thought that was a really interesting way to say, you know, that you were, that the songs are there, but then how they procreate and how they become what they are is an interesting process.
I think for us, the writing has always been pretty traditional. The songs, we try to make sure that they can be played in some sort of representative way on the acoustic guitar or the piano. And then we take them and dress them differently from record to record. And that's been the sort of interesting part from record to record. I think with this, we've lately become really big admirers of bands like Depeche Mode and Gary Newman in the way that they kind of meshed the man and machine in that process. When you look at a record like Violator by Depeche Mode, all those songs, they're great songs, you know, they're proper songs, with verse, chorus, middle, eight, chorus, out type thing, you know. So I think to keep ourselves interested as well, we kind of build up new toys, you know, when it comes around to making a new record. And I often think that listening to other bands' records, you can hear when they've got a new toy to play with. There's a great childish excitement about it, you know.
And in the first two tracks, actually, I re-fell in love because I got this back in April, and then I'm driving and I'm like, uh-oh, I have to go back, although I had already played them. But, you know, what you're describing about the build and the instrumentation, the first two tracks of this record, that's all you need to know how true that is, because Hey Annalena was the first exposure, you know, because you start at the beginning, and it starts so quietly, and you're thinking, okay, I don't know, there's not much. And then boom, and next thing you know, but then it gets quiet again. From songwriting point of view, it does all the things it's supposed to do. It goes back to the refrain, it does have a place it goes away, it does challenge you along the way, and yet, and again, it's what I fall in love with, it's still a great pop song.
Okay, yeah, that was, I mean, it was a conscious decision, you know, as our most, to put that first on the record, because it described the journey of the album quite well for us in terms of it opening very starkly and electronically and kind of developing into this very pretty, all five of us kind of going full tilt in the room and then dropping out again, you know.
So one of the things that hasn't been brought out that much, you've kind of mentioned it a couple of times, but I know that people don't pay attention to this, is because we didn't have your first album, we weren't aware of what you and Rob Kerwin do when you get into a room. And I heard you mention that in this case, it was you wanted to come back to Guidance, right?
Yeah, very much so. We're very much influenced by a session we did with Steve Lillywhite for NPR in New York the last time around, and when he just talking about, you know, music making in general and the fact that most bands now have their own studios, their own recording equipment, at least where they can, you know, set it up in their kitchen or their garage or hire a house, and bands have become a lot more self-sufficient and control the means of production in a very healthy way. But that's a double-edged sword, as you know, he felt, and we agreed, because with the last record we did exactly that, and it was an endless process with everyone taking the record home and working on it on their laptop and ending up with sort of various combinations and permutations of direction, and we wanted to just do away with that. And again, we've always been big admirers of say the Motown house band, the Funk Brothers, who were this just the intuition that would have developed over all that playing and all that proper musicianship was something that you can't achieve by the kind of modern methods of recording, where everything is possible and there's an endless amount of tracks and time. So I suppose we wanted to regress to a time where you had to rehearse until you're ready to kind of just take a photograph of that rehearsal and use a really good studio to do that quickly.
And you also went to the middle of nowhere to sum up the parts, right? This Grouse Lodge sounds like a place that you could either sit there and smoke a lot of dope or make a record, right?
I mean, it is in the middle. It's in the middle of Ireland, middle of the countryside. It's actually a place where Michael Jackson spent quite a bit of time shortly before his death, and was very much left alone there with his family. And, you know, we've yet to hear the kind of fruits of that time, which is, you know, will obviously be, you know, very, very much anticipated. But it was somewhere we went with Rob for a very finite amount of time. We had a month. We were going to do it in that time, no matter what happened. And it just felt like a kind of rediscovery. Also, we'd never recorded as five before. We've recorded as three or four. So we've always had to project beyond what was happening in the room and imagine other parts on top of what we were doing. So, you know, this was the first time we had the full picture.
It's almost like a delay factor. We had the killing here of the economy, and it's still going on there in a big way. So there's also some very strong messages that probably people here don't really realize. They don't know what they're listening to, right?
Yeah, it's quite a, I suppose, a piece of commentary on a specifically Irish period of time, but I think there's a global dimension to it as well, as you say. But I think Ireland definitely suffered a very extreme boom and bust, and it was essentially at the hands of shamefully bad leadership. Also, you know, I think our supposed immaturity as a nation came to the fore, in terms of we're a very young country and we'd never really had money before, and I think the problem was we didn't know how to deal with it in the leadership didn't lead and kind of provide for the future. It just became this kind of debauched party.
EMI is up for auction. They just literally said the people who bought it, Citigroup, is going to auction it off to the highest bidder. Now imagine you're working at Capitol Records at Hollywood and Vine, that you'll be minutes from tomorrow, and you look over that building, and everybody in that building who's working is about to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. You discovered this whole little trend way too early. I mean, not way too, it was good for you, but it was a long time ago. And did you kind of see the shape of things to come? I mean, did you, or was it just more that they just didn't do the right thing for you?
I think, you know, we signed our first deal when we were 20 years of age, and we were, you know, wide-eyed and dizzy with it all. And we released three records with a major throughout Europe. And, you know, it was a time, I suppose in hindsight, we feel like we rode the death throes of the majors in terms of them spending money and us building a fan base from which we could, you know, then put out our own records and, suppose, become masters of our own destiny and own our own records. I think there's as a point of principle, there's a certain satisfaction to that. Probably means little tangible difference, but there's definitely a sort of...
Well, nobody's selling any records anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Well, you know, I think it's a crazy, interesting time of flux and change, and that, you know, they'll do their dance and they'll morph, and, you know, the acquisition of money will win out in the end.
If you are indeed the second biggest band in Ireland, you're getting my sarcasm here. How big do you want to be here? I mean, because you're playing a beautiful venue. You're playing the Troubadour. These are legendary, cool venues. And you are making a living and have made a living as a band, you know. And you do get to play big festivals over there. But, I mean, do you really care? Do you give... I can say this on the radio here. This word's allowed. Do you give a shite if you're, you know, you're suddenly playing the Staples Center in L.A.? Or is that kind of like the antithesis and you're thinking, oh, our music's going to get lost in there?
You know, it's just been really satisfying to see how things are kind of building here, albeit very slowly. Whether we get to the Staples Center or not. I mean, we've done a couple of those kinds of shows, and definitely the subtlety goes out the window. And it's a very different animal. So, you know, we've had the pleasure of playing these venues with incredible heritage. I mean, all we can hope to do is keep doing it.
We do a thing called a musical sandwich, and it's a couple of your songs as the bread, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.